This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Glynis Board. This morning, we'll hear from award-winning filmmaker Elaine McMillian Sheldon about her passion for shining a light on the resilience and strength of Appalachians.
To this day, when I pass the hills or mountains that there's fog rolling out of them or mist rolling out of them that I don't stop and take a photo, I regret it. But it seems that when reporters come to Appalachia, it's like, number one, run down homes and abandoned toys. Let's show how desperate the situation is. When, you know, the reality is that's some kid's toy, and I'm sure if you talk to them, they'd have a full story in and of themselves that paints a different story than desperation.
That's coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. An executive order reopening in-person visits for nursing homes in certain counties takes effect today. Emily Allen has more.
Nursing homes will again allow in-person visits. The areas with high rates of COVID-19 cases, however, will still be closed to visitors. The severity of cases in each county are tracked and updated on a color-coded map on the state's website for COVID-19 response. This is the same map the Department of Education is using to determine their reopening guidelines. 2 weeks ago, Justice issued an executive order temporarily barring people from visiting nursing homes. He is rescinding that order. Health officials still advise people to check with their nursing home first before arranging for a visit. The Justice Administration said it was tracking more than 30 nursing home outbreaks statewide. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Allen.
In the latest episode of Inside Appalachia, we hear stories about people who are finding inner strength to overcome substance use disorder challenges. Despite the fact that most of us have been touched by the substance use disorder crisis, stigmas still exist that create barriers and keep people from getting help. But there are heroes among us who are trying to break those barriers down. Several of these heroes are featured in two Netflix documentaries, Heroin and Recovery Boys, both directed by Elaine McMillian Sheldon and her husband, Curran Sheldon. Elaine and Curran both grew up in West Virginia. Back in 2018, just before the release of Recovery Boys, Elaine sat down with Sarah Smarsh, host of the podcast The Homecomers, to talk about what drove her to devote her career to telling stories about both the difficult realities and the resilience of Appalachians.
In previous interviews, you have said that there are a lot of stereotypes about opioids and who is vulnerable to that addiction and what that looks like in a community. You've pushed back on that before and said all of us are one bad injury away from the danger zone of getting hooked, and also that this crisis really knows no class, race, or gender. I wanted to kind of explore the class angle of that specifically. Wealthy Americans are actually doing better than ever. From 2000 to 2014, wealthy Americans gained 5 years in life expectancy, but poor Americans did not improve. Mm-hmm. Men in the top 1% live 15 years longer than those in the bottom 1%. For women, it's a difference of about 10 years. And then maybe most relevant to your work and the place where you train your camera lens, rural middle-aged white women in particular have seen a mortality rate increase of almost 50% since 1990. That's according to a Washington Post data analysis. Mm-hmm. So economic status certainly affects outcomes. Mm-hmm. What is the relationship between class and addiction, and specifically rural life and addiction?
You know, one of the reasons it's important to say that addiction sees no gender, race, and class is for a number of reasons. Communities of color have been completely disregarded in the conversation of rehabilitation, have been completely locked up and thrown away for their addictions. And I think it's a valid point to question why the opioid crisis is getting so much attention right now when it's largely affecting white populations. In terms of class, you know, when heroin came out, there was a review, and someone had written this about heroin. The concept of seeing people from a lower income town struggling with addiction could turn some people off and lose their interest right off the bat. So the fact that we have such a minor capacity to care about a class that we know nothing about butts up against a lot of the work I'm doing. I think there are very clear indicators that say chronic poverty and addiction go hand in hand. When you're in a system that's broken, when you're in a household that drugs are present, or a household that isn't stable. I mean, that's not just in white rural or black urban. That's across the board. But I think that for me, I mean, I came into this with this knowledge that my friends were dying. I went to this thing with my parents and found out that a girl that I went to prom with was found dead in a Kentucky hotel. She had overdosed, and her boyfriend was being potentially charged with her murder because he had supplied the drugs. And then I had friends that I found out when I was filming a scene for Recovery Boys during Overdose Awareness Day. I heard their names being called out over the speaker when they were naming all the OD victims. So, and those are all women. I have a handful of male friends that have overdosed as well, but majority of my experience has been losing female friends from middle school and high school who I've lost touch with. I think that when we talk about rural addiction, I think as a society, we still see this as a bad decision, as a moral failure. And until we take morality out of it and truly understand the many different factors that steer someone towards addiction, or, you know, some of the girls that I knew actually were prescribed OxyContin. You know, 4 out of 5 heroin users started with a legal pill. So I just think there's a lot of misunderstanding around how powerful these drugs are. And, you know, when you're looking at a rural community, I think there's like 3 or 4 needle exchanges, syringe exchanges in West Virginia. So some people are traveling like 6 hours round trip to get clean needles. And this is a huge dispute in Charleston, where I live right now. Our mayor is wanting to shut down our syringe exchange by over-exaggerating the number of needles that are on the street, when in fact the needle exchange itself is based on the fact that you bring in the used needles and they exchange them for clean needles. This is the whole idea of a needle exchange, to get needles off the street. So there's just a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of morality brought to the conversation about who's worthy, even within the same class. People that are judging those for being on welfare, you know, they feel a higher moral standard because they themselves aren't on welfare. You're seeing that the same thing with people suffering from addiction. The substance is irrelevant to me. That's what I've learned in the filmmaking process. It really doesn't matter. I mean, alcohol kills tons of people. You know, the substance is irrelevant. It's the disconnection from society that is the part we have to heal. And the guys that we film in Recovery Boys are all feeling a lack of belonging when they come to rehab. They've been so isolated with whatever substance that they were hooked on at that moment that they have no sense of belonging to a larger community. And that's where America really needs to step up and take responsibility with the environments we create, the stigma, whether it's class stigma or addiction stigma, the whole idea that some people are worth a second chance and others aren't. A child from an upper middle class family in Connecticut is worth a third chance and has access to rehab, but a kid from a quote-unquote bad family from Morgantown, West Virginia should rot in jail or just let him die. There's very clear standards in how we treat people. I'm still learning every day. I learn from the guys that we've been filming. I learn from the women in heroin. And I think the biggest thing for me is learning that, you know, addiction cannot manifest and grow and fester and sort of get out of control in strong communities that look out for one another. Addiction is only fed by isolation in America, and that's stigmatizing.
That was filmmaker Elaine McMillian Sheldon speaking with Sarah Smarsh, host of the podcast The Homecomers. More of their conversation can be heard on the latest episode of Inside Appalachia. Find it online at wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Saturday marked the start of BriannaCon in Kentucky, a 4-day community convention aimed at raising awareness about the police killing of Breonna Taylor. But BriannaCon and the group that organized it have faced criticism over the branding and intention of the event. Eleanor Klibanoff with the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting explains.
About 100 women gathered inside Vibes nightclub on Saturday afternoon, dressed to the nines. There was an ivy-covered wall bearing glasses of champagne, a buffet, gift bags full of swag, all the makings of a good party. But it wasn't a party. These women were there for an event about Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old woman killed by Louisville Metro Police in March.
This event is about, it's tailor-made, Breonna Taylor made, and it's a woman's empowerment event.
That's Lanita Baker, a lawyer representing Taylor's family. She was there with reality TV stars, actresses, and speakers to help raise awareness about Taylor's death.
Justice, because we're all here because we want justice for Breonna. And I know me, myself, I'm not going to fight until we have justice for Breonna. And I know that a lot, most of the people, if not hopefully everyone in this room, are here until the end, until we have full justice for Breonna.
Welcome to the first day of BreonnaCon, a four-day event put on by Until Freedom, a national social justice organization that relocated to Louisville to advocate for Taylor full-time. Until Freedom and BreonnaCon have both garnered criticism. Some local activists feel the group has parachuted in and is interfering with the long-term work already underway. Chanel Helm runs Black Lives Matter Louisville. She says before any national group showed up, it was just regular people leading the movement.
And that's who we should be moving with and assisting them in that. So I'm disappointed is what I am, especially in this moment, a moment that we've been preparing for all of our lives, really.
Helm says they tried to find ways to work with Until Freedom early on, but felt the group focused on the Taylor case to the exclusion of other important issues facing Black Louisvillians. Until Freedom co-founder Linda Sarser says they're there to amplify the good work already happening in Louisville and are willing to work with anyone who's willing to work with them.
The protesters of Louisville have been exhausted. They've been on the front lines for 86 days. They have done everything that they could with the very little resources that they have. And so we are here to say we're going to give you what we have and work right alongside of you.
Some local advocacy groups appreciate the national attention and resources Until Freedom has brought to Louisville. The group distributed boxes of food with the Louisville Urban League and is organized with the Kentucky Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. But their latest event has once again put Until Freedom into the position of defending itself. On social media, local and national activists have criticized the group for the branding of BreonnaCon. They're hosting events with titles like BreBQ and a Bros for Breonna Men's Empowerment event.
Everyone's response to these events has been, we don't want this, we don't appreciate it, it's inappropriate, it's disrespectful.
Ja'Cory Arthur is a local musician, teacher, and was recently elected to Metro Council. He said he agreed to speak on a panel at BreonnaCon, but as he learned more, he decided to back out.
But these events do not impact Daniel Cameron's decision. He's not looking at them as some sort of pressure or some sort of tipping point for what's going to come whenever it comes from his office.
Until Freedom is planning a march Tuesday on LMPD's training facility, but until then, BreonnaCon is focusing mostly on community service and empowerment events like Taylor Made. Back at Vibes, Until Freedom co-founder Tamika Mallory kicked off the event by addressing the controversy BreonnaCon attracted on social media. She said Breonna Taylor's family fully supports everything they're doing, and that's the only thing that matters to her. She said she recently talked to Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, about the upcoming BreBQ event.
When we were talking about BreBQ, and Lanita, you were there, she looked at me with almost tears in her eyes and said, wow, Breonna would love BreBQ. And so y'all can kiss my butt.
For the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, I'm Eleanor Klibanoff.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Andrea Billups is our news director. I'm your host and producer, Glynis Ford. This is West Virginia Morning.